He will not be able to be modest and chaste. Same thing goes with having good manners and the other attributes which have been mentioned in this beautiful hadith. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at freedom and the importance of freedom in the words of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
In what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Qabit Aghwai. It seemed to be a major announcement from Iran's capital, Tehran. Iran and the European Union say the talks on reviving the 2015 Iran deal will resume in the coming days. Yet what is not said here is why there was a break in the talks in the first place, namely how the U.S. prevented for the talks to actually progress. Another issue, whether the U.S. will make the or have the political will to make the decision, that is, lift sanctions and not lay down any new conditions. Just some of the angles we'll be discussing in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests for this program. Political analyst Said Mostafa Khoshchesh joins us from the capital, Tehran. Also joining us is political analyst Elijah Magnier, who joins us from Marseille in France.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I will start with you first, Said Mostafa Khoshchesh, since you're here in the capital, Tehran, and I'm sure you saw the press conference. What do you think?
Hello, Kavan. Thanks for having me. I'm not sure if you have my picture or not.
Yes, we do.
I believe you're just having my voice. Anyway, despite the very fact that some might see the development today as a major positive development since Borrell and the Iranian foreign minister both promised, imminent resumption of talks. I don't see much of a breakthrough here. Yes, that they were speaking in positive words, but there have been problems, some unresolved issues regarding removal of some sanctions that have remained on the table. And also with regard to some parts of the guarantees, these are two of the main issues that have remained unresolved. And Iran presented its own initiative last month when Mora was in Tehran. they were happy. I mean, Mora and Joseph Borrell, after he went back to Europe, Borrell heard the Iranian initiative. They were happy. But as soon as they saw the reaction of the Americans, they were upset again. And those remaining issues are still over there, unresolved, while the Americans have stated that they would not remove the sanctions on the IRGC, as Rob Molly said during the Senate hearing last month. And the following day, the U.S. President Joe Biden said that the window of opportunity for giving any more merits in any, you know, area has been shut down, meaning that basically there won't be any need for further talks. Because when you say that I'm not going to, you know, give any kind of concessions, why should there be any kind of talks? So basically today it was another case of Joseph Borrell's positive gesture in order to give some kind of momentum to the talks that have, you know, been there at a standstill situation, and there's not been any major development. So he wants to push it forwards. You know, he wants to set the stage and provide a positive atmosphere and give him momentum and bring the talks back to the headlines to see if there could be any progress in the talks.
Okay. Well, this is what the EU foreign policy, amongst many statements, has made there, Elijah Magnier. One of them, he said he was pleased a decision to resume the talks had been accepted both in Tehran and Washington. So the basic question comes here is that what did he do, or, as to use his word, facilitate? I'm not too sure what facilitate means. Maybe you can tell us that also, Elijah Magnier. But what did either Tehran or Washington, or should I say the EU also in that mix, make in order for this to resume?
The only way for the talk to move forward is for the U.S. to accept to give up some concessions and to offer some guarantee that Iran is asking. Unless Iran is ready to give concession from its side, accepting that any deal can last for 2 years only, as long as President Biden is in power, accepting also that perhaps, or trusting that he's not going to implement other sanctions under different titles, so maybe that is the way for the deal to forward, even if it's not going to last for very long, because we don't know the identity of the next president. So we see Iran very adamant of asking for guarantee how this is going to be respected, and how Biden himself, before even ending his term, is not going to come back from the window and impose other sanctions on Iran under different titles and say this is not related to the JCPOA. So all these concern and lack of trust, this is why agreements are made to be signed. However, the lack of trust also in the U.S., because even if they sign an agreement, it doesn't mean they will abide by it, because we've seen not only the JCPOA revoked in 2018, but we also have seen treaties in Kaliningrad with Russia and the EU, and other treaties are not respected and international laws thrown out of the windows. So when I hear Joseph Borrell saying this is against the international law, since when Europe has respected the international law, particularly related to the JCPOA, because it didn't respect its end of the deal? Not only the US, but the EU was afraid of honoring the deal. So I don't know how this is going to work out, and I am honestly, I doubt about it.
Well, it's very hard to understand Joseph Borrell, say Mostafa Khoshesh, when he gets on that podium, as he did today. I'm not trying to criticize him, but I'm just trying to understand what's going on. And he talks about how, the EU is going to be the facilitator, and that he's very happy that these talks are going to progress, when just weeks ago at the EU Board of Governors, that was a different story, when that anti-Iran resolution was passed. How do you come, the Iranian side, how would they trust that entity called the EU through Borrell to then be optimistic to move forward? I mean, how does that work out?
Well, you're right. As a matter of fact, they've been, you know, helping the United States to pressure Tehran including their resolution at the Board of Governors of the IAEA. But they, at the same time, they try to pretend to be the middleman, the neutral party, which has never been the case. After the U.S. exited the deal and dropped out of the deal very illegally, they promised to make up for the lost interests, promised to Tehran. And they took Tehran and discouraged Rouhani's administration from taking reciprocal action for 14 months. They promised, they made promises, but they have never done anything. As a matter of fact, they've just been party to the deal when it was being endorsed. Otherwise, they've never been an independent party to provide Tehran with any kind of merit all throughout the past several years. They have never punished the United States. They had the possibility to work on legal mechanisms in order to, fine the companies, the private sector companies, to avoid obedience to the United States and encourage them to defy the U.S. Illegal unilateral sanctions against Iran. But they never did that. As a matter of fact, there have been more than 100 major EU state companies that could have worked with Iran even after the U.S. dropped out of the deal, but they never pressured the states in Europe. They never pressured their own state companies to stay under the deal and to work with Tehran. That's a breach, a significant breach of the paragraphs 25, 6, or 4 of the JCPOA. But let me remind you here that the U.S. seems to be very much adamant here to comply with, the undertakings that it has under the JCPOA, because for the last 3 months, there's been some kind of war of willpower between the two sides, Iran and the United States here, who are the main actors nowadays when it comes to the Vienna talks. And the Americans, after the Iranians invited Mora and offered him their new initiative, the Americans, they came forward and said that they would not grant any kind of concessions, not only with regard to the IRGC sanctions, but also with regard to other merits. They would not grant any kind of merit. And then they stopped, negotiations, and they went for, some kind of hybrid warfare against Iran, using media warfare, propaganda, encouraging riots, as well as, showing support for the opposition, the guys that have always been supported by the United States and the West, and they are based in Europe and in the United States. Also, they waged cyber attacks against Iran and supported Israel in that aspect. And also, they used Israel as a strategic partner for doing terror attacks and sabotage in Iran. And also, they ordered the seizure of Iranian crude cargo offshore Greece, which was reciprocated by Iran seizing two ships of Greece. Uh-huh. To show that enough is enough. This is not the Rouhani administration that was practicing appeasement policy. This is the revolutionary government of Raisi, who was elected to office and to power by those who were critical of Rouhani's appeasement policy, because, right, tolerating the United States never ended up in any good result for Tehran. So Iranians voted for Raisi, so his strategy is active resistance diplomacy and showing power. So then they moved to the IAEA Board of Governors to use it also as a leverage, political leverage, diplomatic leverage against Iran. So as you see, it's a hybrid warfare using different means in order to pressure Tehran to step back. So it seems that Americans are not prepared, really, to go for real negotiations. They are just thinking of using pressure against Iran, which has not been successful policy at all so far.
List of anti-Iran sanctions, anti-Iran actions there, Elijah Magnier, our guest, talked about. I'm curious if they are under the impression that they're going to continue doing that if there was an agreement
I mean, is that, it doesn't, it seems like that's a line that they have followed and will continue to follow. Do you get the impression, again, we're speculating here, if there was any type of agreement that the U.S., along with Israel, and all the different anti-Iran actions that they've executed is something that's going to continue?
Look, it's very simple. Iran is increasing the weight, I mean, in kilos of the uranium. So it has reached 3,000, hasn't reached the 6,000 that used to possess in 2015. And Iran is threatening to remove more cameras. So far, 27 cameras were removed to blind a little bit the IAEA from some sites. At the end of the day, Iran is saying, I don't want the nuclear bomb, and I'm not going to make a nuclear bomb, and I am showing you some of my...
Okay, looks like we're having problems.
I understand that very well, and it's aware that you're not going to go beyond that, and because you're not going to go beyond that, it's not going to lift the sanction, and is blackmailing Iran to force it toward more concessions. This is why the West feels more tranquil about not giving Iran what it's asking, because you're not going to reach the nuclear bomb. That's it.
It's very interesting, don't you think, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, when you have a Borrell say, we are prepared to resume talks in the coming days. What is important for Iran is to fully receive the economic benefits of the 2015 accord. Something that was reiterated by the Iranian foreign minister, in which Borrell repeated, Iran has to receive the full economic benefits. But he's making that statement out of the capital, Iran's capital. Shouldn't he be in Washington telling the American side, lift those sanctions?
Exactly. Exactly. That was what I wanted to say. As a matter of fact, you should be in Washington asking them why, if you're really up for a deal with Iran or talks with Iran, and then why did you declare that they would not remove the IRGC from the FTO list in the Senate hearing and vice versa? You started saying that you would, I mean, Rob Molly said at the same Senate hearing that they would go for declaring more sanctions on IRGC. Now, this kind of action was even protested by Rand Paul at the same Senate hearing, saying, what kind of a negotiation is this? You say you would not grant any kind of merit to Tehran, and at the same time, you are adding up to your pressure. So this means that you are adamant to talks. You know, let's be honest. The Americans do not want a fair deal. And Joseph Borrell doesn't have the power, or maybe the EU is not willing at all, and it doesn't have the power either, to pressure the United States. So he is trying to convince Iran. Iran has presented this initiative last month. It's the United States that has been adamant to the initiative, the new initiative, and many others. And it's been the United States that has not been, you know, flexible. And it's the United States that's saying that it's not going to give Iran anything. So what kind of negotiation could be on the way when this is the case? As a matter of fact, the U.S. wants to pressure Tehran, to bully Tehran to step back. But they are coming to realize, especially after Iran's reactions with regard to the seizure of its crude cargo, as well as to the IAEA Board of Governors resolution, which received Iran's tough response, they are realizing that this kind of maximum pressure policy that they condemn, but they still continue under Biden, would not end up in any kind of result for them. That's why they have sent Borrell to Tehran, to soften Tehran's, you know, a voice and to encourage Iran to change direction. It reminds me of the same kind of action that they did when they were about to, you know, vote for a resolution at the Board of Governors. I mean, the three European countries as well as the United States. Iran said that it would reciprocate this action. Then they sent some, some parties to Iran to discourage Iran from taking reciprocal action. And they said if Tehran promises not to take any kind of hostile action, then the United States and Europeans would soften the tone of that Board of Governors resolution. Iranian response was simple. whatever you do under the title of a resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors will receive Iran's response in proportion. No matter what kind of language you use, what kind of action you do, it would be reciprocated. So Tehran did that. As a matter of fact, Tehran not only dismantled 27 cameras that were there mounted under the JCPOA, okay, though there are still many other cameras installed, working, operating under the NPT at all Iranian facilities. Iran also started a couple of cascades of highly advanced centrifuge machines to show that it would answer and show reaction, top reaction to any kind of hostile action to deter any further sure. U.S. hostility. The Americans, I believe, have come to realize that this kind of bullying policy would not, you know, end up in good results. So sure. they have asked Borrell to come to Tehran to, you know, discourage Iran from further reciprocal actions.
I'd like to find out from you, Elijah Magnier, whether maybe we're looking at a scenario that is a little bit different from what, say, Mostafa Khoshnesh talked about in terms of the EU vis-a-vis the U.S., and that is the fact that we're looking, obviously, at the conflict in Ukraine and how the EU is suffering immensely, much like the rest of the world, really, but in terms of the energy shortages that they're facing, and whether there is an incentive for the EU to want Iran to come back to the fore, to come back to the scene, for them to want to purchase Iranian oil, and in particular, in gas. And that is something that the EU has to convince the U.S. Of acceptance, because it's not the U.S. that's going to suffer as much as we're seeing the EU. Do you think that's a possibility?
Absolutely not, because what you're missing here, I've been hustled among the corridors of the EU commissions and decision makers. The EU is colonized by the U.S. Every single decision taken by the EU leaders comes from the U.S. and looks after the U.S. interest and not the European continent and the inhabitants' interest. We've seen that, as you rightly said, in the war in Ukraine, how the EU imposed sanctions on Russia, and we have inflation going out up the roof. And what's happening is we are paying the price of the wrong decision of our leaders in Europe. And regardless, the Americans are still saying you impose further sanctions. So all decisions made by the EU come from the US. Joseph Borrell would have never come to Tehran without the consensus of the US. And anything that Europe is saying is only seeking the US interest in the first place. Of course, it is in the EU interest for Iran to return to the market, because we desperately need of oil and gas. So the energy lacking in Europe is obvious and going to be even worse in the coming month, and particularly when we go toward the end of the year. So the interest of the EU is not at stake here, is only what the US wants, and the EU doesn't have an opinion, really. And we've seen that from 2018 to today with the JCPOA, how Europe was incapable and impotent to do anything toward Iran to respect this deal.
My last question has to go on the statements made by Ali Shamkhani, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshnesh, which he's the Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council. Obviously, what he says needs to get a reaction on. Iran will further develop its nuclear program until the West changes its illegal behavior, further adding Iran's retaliatory actions in the nuclear sector merely legal and rational responses to U.S. unilateralism and European inaction, and will continue as long as the West's illegal practices are not changed. Your reaction, please, in less than a minute, please.
As I said, the Rouhani era is gone. Now Iran has been, left with one single option after the U.S. illegal, irresponsible discarding of the nuclear deal. Tehran's trust has been ruined in any kind of deal with them. So Tehran has been left with one option, showing power, while the United States is at the end of the road of its maximum pressure policy, which is admittedly being a failure.
Okay.
Both governments, the Trump and Biden, have admitted that. Now Tehran has multiple options available in the missile industry, regional power, nuclear power, and many others, to increase leverage on the United States, and the global energy prices would soon rise again when, purchases for fall arrive, and that would add up to pressure on the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, sorry to jump in. We're just fresh out of time, said Mustafa Khoshesh, political analyst, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier. Thank you from Marseille, France. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أولئك يجزون الغرفة بما صبروا ويلقون فيها تحية وسلاما
Those will be awarded the chamber for what they patiently endured, and they will be received therein with greetings and words of peace.
The 75th verse of this chapter says, أولئك يجزون الغرفة بما صبروا وَيُلَقَّوْنَ فِيهَا تَحِيَّةً وَسَلَامًا Those servants of the Beneficent shall be rewarded with the high stations because they were patient, and they shall be met therein with welcome and salutations. So, as you have been previously with us, we have counted about 13 different attributes for the special servants of the Almighty Allah, or the so-called Ibadur Rahman, as the Holy Qur'an itself mentioned. From the 63rd verse up to now, different attributes were counted by the different verses of the Holy Qur'an. Ibadur Rahman, those true servants of the Almighty Allah, are the ones that walk on earth humbly. They answer peace when the ignorant address them, and they are the ones spending the night prostrating themselves before their Lord. They call out to their Lord and ask Him to avert them from the torment of hell because they know It has a very lasting affliction, and it is an evil abode. When they want to spend, they are stationed between the two extremes of extravagant and niggardly. They do not call with Allah any other god. They do not slay the soul which Allah has forbidden, and they do not commit fornication. They are the ones who witness no falsehood, and when they pass by what is vain, they pass by nobly. They are not deaf and blind to the signs of their Lord, and they humbly ask the Almighty Allah to give the joy of their eyes from their wives and their offspring. And the last attribute, they want to be the imams for the pious ones. Now, after completing these attributes, these special servants of Allah with their attributes are referred to, and in a short conclusion, their divine reward is brought up. And it says, أُولَٰئِكَ يُجْزَوْنَ الْغُرْفَةَ بِمَا صَبَرُوا. Those servants of the Beneficent shall be rewarded with the high stations because they were patient. The verse says, أُولَٰئِكَ يُجْزَوْنَ الْغُرْفَةَ. They shall be rewarded with high stations. The Arabic word غُرْفَةَ means something that is picked up and consumed, such as water that man gets from spring or drinking. And then, this word has been applied to upper parts and stories of a building and houses. Here, it implies the best places of the paradise, the highest ranks available in paradise. So, since the servants of the Beneficent, Ibadur Rahman, with such attributes, are in the first row of other believers, their heavenly rank and position must also be the greatest and highest. أولئك يجزون الغرفة بما صبروا.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine.
In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
حفظ الكتاب بصدره فبدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So these special servants of the Almighty Allah with their tributes are referred to, their reward is mentioned, and their reward is that they are in the highest stations in paradise. Of course, it must be noted that this high rank is given to them because they have been patient. Explicitly, the Holy Quran says, يُجْزَوْنَ الْغُرْفَةَ بِمَا صَبَرُ. They were tolerant for the sake of Allah. It may be thought that this is another attribute of theirs, but it is not a new one. It somehow guarantees the fulfillment of the previous attributes. Because let's just consider it. Is it possible to worship Allah, to be humble, to be modest, to struggle with low desires and to stop vain witness without patience, without perseverance? Does not seem to be possible. This statement reminds one of the famous tradition stated by Imam Ali alayhi salam, who said, "The relationship of the patience and tolerance with faith is like the relationship of the head with body. The survival of the body depends on the existence of the head because it controls all the limbs. It is located in the man's head, and so is the station of patience." So this Quranic word, sabr, has got an extensive concept which includes tolerance and resistance against the difficulties being on the path of the worshipping of the Almighty Allah. It means to be tolerant against the low desires. It means to struggle against them. If in some narration we read that its purpose is only poverty and financial weakness, they are, as we have said many times, the possible extensions, clear extensions of it, and they do not limit the extensiveness and the meaning of this word. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As Italy's socioeconomic conditions worsen by the day, the country is witnessing an endless number of protests and strikes. On Friday, the Italian Association of Private Construction and Building Technicians staged a protest against the government's decision to suspend the so-called Superbonus scheme. The measure, which granted homeowners access to a tax credit of up to 110% on the cost of upgrading their home, was introduced in 2020 in an attempt to counter the nefarious effects on the economy of the COVID crisis.
This bonus was a real blessing for us. Finally, after decades, we stopped lowering our bids. But suddenly, not only the price of building materials sharply increased, but also the government stopped funding the scheme under the pretext that some companies were cheating.
È una vergogna.
The government should be ashamed. Building companies are going bankrupt. 200,000 workers will soon lose their job. We are furious.
Meanwhile, taxi drivers across Italy have staged the umpteenth strike action, disrupting traffic in several cities. Taxi drivers are on the warpath with the government over an EU directive which aims at liberalizing the sector.
The National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, has said household consumer confidence has plummeted in June amidst great preoccupation for energy rising costs and for the ramifications of the Ukraine crisis. Quite surprisingly, consumer confidence is up for the second consecutive month.
Also on Friday, USB-based union staged a protest at the Ministry of Economic Development against, quote, Italy's unsustainable precarization of work. USB says young Italians are only offered temporary, badly paid jobs.
Salaries in Italy haven't grown for over 30 years. Nevertheless, military spending is on the rise. Ours is the EU country with the highest number of contracts regulating badly paid casual work.
Italians are also very worried about the water drought that has afflicted the country over the past weeks. Several regions are mulling over introducing water rationing to manage the limitation of water. The Lombardy region on Friday declared a state of emergency for drought after water levels in the Po River fell by over three quarters amid the worst drought in 70 years. Max Civili, Rome.
The United Nations has confirmed what has been abundantly clear all along, that Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh was killed by Israeli fire.
Based on this very rigorous monitoring, we find that the shots that killed Abu Akleh came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians.
Abu Akleh, a veteran Al Jazeera journalist, was killed while covering an Israeli army raid on Jenin in the northern occupied West Bank on May 11th. Multiple witnesses had already said that Israeli forces killed the Al Jazeera reporter. Investigations conducted by several media organizations have also come to the same conclusion. Al Jazeera and its host country, Qatar, pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. The killing also fits the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. The UN Human Rights Office spokeswoman suggested that Abu Akleh and her fellow journalists were deliberately targeted.
At around 6:30 in the morning, as four of the journalists turned into the street leading to the camp, wearing bulletproof helmets and flak jackets with press markings, several single, seemingly well-aimed bullets were fired towards them from the direction of the Israeli security forces. One single bullet injured Ali Samoudi in the shoulder, and another single bullet hit Abu Akleh in the head and killed her instantly.
The UN expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into the killing. It urged Tel Aviv to open a criminal investigation, not just into Abu Akleh's killing, but also all other killings and serious injuries by Israeli forces in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. That is likely to be an impossibly long list. So far this year alone, The UN Human Rights Office has verified that Israeli forces have killed 58 Palestinians in the West Bank, including 13 children. The Israeli army says it's not possible to determine if its forces were responsible for Abu Akleh's killing. The murder sparked outrage from Palestinians and around the world, with thousands attending her funeral in occupied East al-Quds. Yet that fury has yet to translate into concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. And in the absence of such action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against Palestinians, whether journalist or not, whether well-known or not, will end anytime soon.
As part of my visit program to Medina, I visited the first mosque in the world that dates to the lifetime of the Islamic prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in the 7th century CE. With its shining white minarets, the Quba Mosque is a sacred place of worship for Muslims.
It's believed that it was built by the prophet himself in the city of Medina following his migration from Mecca to this city. Therefore, this mosque holds a very special place in the hearts of Muslim devotees.
Quba Mosque is the second largest and most prestigious mosque in the city after the Prophet's Mosque. It's a unique landmark and its white building can be clearly seen from a distance. The mosque has gone through several rounds of renovation during the years and now has 4 minarets and 56 domes. This mosque is said to be where the first Friday prayer was held, led by the Holy Prophet Muhammad. It holds value to millions of Muslims around the world who wish to visit it at least once in their lifetime. The Islamic traditions have highly recommended performing prayers in this mosque.
Whoever performs ablutions in one's home and offers one prayer in Quba Mosque will be rewarded the equivalent of one umrah.
At the end of my visit, I joined pilgrims from several countries in the courtyard of the mosque for eating food votives, pieces of bread, yogurt, dates and coffee are the simple treats that Muslims offer to pilgrims to thank God or in the memory of the Holy Prophet. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
Germany, home to the second biggest Muslim community in Western Europe after France. It's also home to a growing number of racist attacks on Muslims by neo-Nazis and far-right extremists. Rights group FAIR International, which has founded Germany's first reporting center for attacks on mosques, has recorded nearly 840 such incidents since 2014. A case in point, the horrifying 2014 arson attack that gutted Berlin's Mevlana Mosque. German police are usually quick to show up on the scene, but in most cases, FAIR International says, the crimes are not properly investigated.
Just 10% they find the people who have done it. So 90%, and they knew maybe who has done it. And that shows that even the government, the police, and some people of the government are together with them.
The attacks are not limited to Muslim places of worship. Physical assaults on Muslim men and women are also an almost daily occurrence.
A 2019 study found that more than half of Germans view Islam as a threat. In the same year, nearly 1,000 incidents were reported against Muslims and institutions. And in 2020, at least one Muslim individual or mosque was either physically assaulted or received death threats almost every day.
Another report published in 2020 criticizes many European states for failing to report on anti-Muslim incidents as a separate category of hate crime.
This plan is against Islam. Everything is planned. And in Germany, the fruits, because of our history, of course, we do have people who are racist. I don't know how much percent. And that is in whole Europe.
Despite all the warnings and criticism, anti-Muslim hatred, fueled by the propaganda of neo-Nazi groups and the far-right opposition parties, has only grown, a reality that does not bode well for the country's nearly 5 million Muslims. Saeed Puriza, London.
Beryansk, a seaside tourist town in Russian-held Ukraine, it is rapidly developing a more Russian feel.
Shops and cafes accept both Ukrainian and Russian currency. SIM cards are only distributed with the Russian calling code. The number plates will soon be changed too. Some people are getting a head start. A school. In the foyer, photos are being taken for the Russian passports that are being offered to the town's residents. I found the teachers here to be pro-Russian.
The feeling when I saw the Russian flag was like, please don't go away, defend us. Our language was being suppressed under the Ukrainian government, and as Russians, we were insulted in the streets. Now we will be able to live the way we want as part of the Russian Federation.
While Russia plays up the support it has from the local population, the West claims there is no support here for the invasion. The truth, like much of this propaganda war, lies somewhere in between. In order to understand Russia's war aims, it's helpful to look at a linguistic map of the country. Crimea, which Russia annexed 8 years ago, is overwhelmingly Russian-speaking, as is the eastern region of Donbass. The more Russia pushes westward and north from Crimea, generally the less support Russia will have from the local population. I took to the streets to ask people how they felt about their new governors, but not a single person would speak to me on camera. The pro-Russians are worried about reprisals from Ukrainians, and pro-Ukrainians worried about the authorities.
Now, I've spoken to about a dozen groups of people here. I'd say about 25% of them were openly pro-Russian, one of them taking a Z symbol out of his bag and showing to me a sign of support for the Russian army. I'd also say there's about 25% of people who are openly pro-Ukrainian, one of them asking to see my British press credentials before telling me his answer. But interestingly, the majority, around 50% of the people I spoke to, say they're more neutral. They don't really mind if it's Russian or Ukrainian rule here. One of the women I spoke to with a teenage daughter said she's got Russian family and Ukrainian family, and she just wants peace. So that's very much the majority view here, just wanting peace.
Many Ukrainians have also fled, not only the war, but Russian rule, meaning the demographics have changed. Some Ukrainians who've left send threat to those who choose to work with the new authorities.
Some people here are afraid. They're being told that the Ukrainian army will come back and imprison us or kill us. And they threaten teachers on the social networks. They demand we don't go to work, or when they return, they will put us in prison. And they send death threats to relatives.
No matter their political views, it's a nervous time for all civilians here. Not least because this being a tourist town, war is not good for business. There is also the threat of a Ukrainian insurgency. While this conflict has become a proxy war between Russia and NATO, most civilians here just want to get on with their lives in peace. Jenny Miller-Berdyansk.
After a 9-hour-long trip from the Afghan capital Kabul, we arrived in Gayan district in southeastern Paktika province, where the 6.1 magnitude earthquake has destroyed more than 1,000 homes and left more than 2,500 victims. The residents have to stay outdoors in the cold weather without access to basic needs.
All houses here have been ruined as a result of the earthquake. In some areas, all members of a single family have been killed. Currently, women, children, and elders are in a very bad situation and need urgent help.
Next day, as the sun rises, we visit more quake-ravaged houses. People still continue the search and rescue operation. It seems like every home here has had some killed or injured.
Mr. Naim Khan says that he has lost two of his relatives and five others are injured. We ask him about this earthquake and about the situation here.
At around 1:30 a.m. Wednesday, the earthquake struck here. Two of my family members were killed and five others injured. We also lost our livestock. Our livelihoods and food supplies are buried under rubble. There's nowhere to go. We need help and our houses should be rebuilt.
Four of the Taliban ministers and aid agencies arrived in the collapsed villages to address the needs of desperate people. They're providing food items, blankets, tents, medicines, and other basic necessities. But it's clear more help is needed.
The leadership has ordered all related governmental institutions to reach the quake-stricken areas and take necessary measures. In addition, the Prime Minister is going to pay money to families of the victims.
Humanitarian aid agencies have arrived here to carry out the required programs. Based on our assessment, more than 8,000 houses have so far been confirmed destroyed here in Gayan. These affected people need help immediately.
The earthquake comes as Afghanistan is facing drought, famine, and hunger, triggered by cuts in global aid and the U.S. sanctions. The Taliban officials have called on the U.S. to release Afghan frozen assets. Rahmatullah Baghban, Paktika province of Afghanistan.
EU leaders held video calls throughout Tuesday to prepare for a summit on Thursday and Friday, at which Ukraine and Moldova will be granted candidate status, which means they move a step closer to joining the 27-country bloc. Georgia will be placed to a stage just below candidate status. EU affairs ministers also met on Tuesday to lay the groundwork.
That's, I think, a very important message. And it's a very important message which comes in a special time where we see this renewed geopolitical rivalry. New global tensions.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has tweeted, "Ukrainians are ready to die for the European perspective. We want them to live with us, the European dream." Not everyone is impressed, given the current state of the EU.
I'd say the Ukrainians would rather live than die. And I'd say now the notion that they want to die for any European dream is a bit fanciful now at best.
Moscow is clearly being told to take note that the EU family is growing.
This is a powerful signal. This is a powerful signal that should be heard not only in Ukraine.
But the message seems to have fallen flat on its face. Vladimir Putin says he's no objections to Ukraine joining the EU. The Kremlin's issue has always been related to Kiev becoming a member of the NATO military alliance. It's been reported that officials in the European Commission filled out the country's EU application form. A number of legislators point out the EU's own studies have found that Ukraine is highly corrupt. Therefore, they suggest the country is not eligible. Analysts say it could take up to 10 years for Ukraine to become a full member of the bloc.
In this context, it has been suggested by some lawmakers here that the true motive is to yet again use Ukraine as a pawn to try and undermine Russia. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
Day one of a three-day strike that's made London's underground network grind to a crawl. Stations normally teeming with people, either closed or offering only a skeletal service. The advice from the authorities, take the bus. Prime Minister Boris Johnson criticized the biggest strike in Britain in a generation as an unnecessary aggravation.
I want to emphasize to everybody this morning why I think those strikes are so wrong, and so unnecessary.
An inconvenience it may be, but the unions say the government left them no choice.
Some of our members have not had a pay rise for the third anniversary now. We can resolve that if we've got a proper negotiating framework, but the fact is that Grant Shapps, Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson are dictating the terms of this dispute. Now, they can either facilitate a settlement or they can block one. At the moment, they're blocking one.
And all this, of course, comes with a cost to the City of London and to the people.
The London Chamber of Commerce says the cost of a strike like this to London's economy is tens of millions of dollars a day. But perhaps the biggest impact the strike is having is the headache it's causing to the nearly 5 million commuters who use the underground to get from A to B on a daily basis.
I think, you know, it's holding people to ransom.
I would say a major inconvenience.
I support the workers getting the right pay they need, and obviously they work really hard. But it's hard not to get annoyed when your journey time is double.
As a teacher, as someone who's just graduating into a profession where there has not been a real terms pay rise in 9 years, I look to the rail workers and I look to the RMT as a beacon of hope.
The strike has shown how dependent London is on its underground network and how powerful unions are. Negotiations for a compromise are ongoing, and so are the strikes. And it doesn't stop with the rail workers. Other professions, such as teaching and healthcare, are also considering industrial action in the UK's summer of unrest. Saeed Purizap, London.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women.